sit down quietly when you're not likely to be disturbed. Relax the body and begin to think about yourself. Every time your thought wanders to something else, bring it back gently but relentlessly. Think about the past. Think of all the mistakes you have made, going all the way back to childhood. Think of all the opportunities you've missed. Especially think of all the occasions upon which you've been badly treated. Think about your body and wonder if age or your job or the climate is beginning to tell on you. See if you can discover a pain or an ache somewhere. In any case, think about yourself. That's the main thing. And if you keep doing this faithfully for at least 15 or 20 minutes, there's no doubt about the results. So that's strikes me as being kind of taking my inventory, because that's what got me here, is thinking about myself and thinking that I could take care of myself, thinking that life went on so that I could stay loaded and half drunk all the time. I was born into a good family. I don't know where the alcoholics were. They're probably hidden or we didn't talk about them. But I started drinking and I really enjoyed it. I liked the buzz. I liked that nice warm feeling. And I'd snitch it, you know. My father had a grocery store and he had lots of beer and he had wine. And he had some wine that was really crappy stuff. I think it was called Zinfandel, and it cost about 49 cents a pint, something like that. I'd smuggle it off his shelf, and then my buddies and I would go out and get really drunk on it and puke our guts out and think we were having a great time. Yeah. And my friends kind of laid off this stuff, but I kept on. I pursued it relentlessly and diligently. And I remember the time that I was able to drink down a whole quart of beer without having to throw up. And I thought, I have arrived. I can hold my liquor. And this is all when I was a teenager. And I got through college and I managed to get into the Army. And in the Army, you're supposed to drink because real men drink. And besides that, it's probably about 15 cents a bottle. So I drank every night and ran through all my money, even drinking 15 cents beer. And it got to be worse and worse. But in the process, and I remember it was in Warrenton, Virginia, we were staying overnight and we had a beer left in the morning. It was still open, and I drank that, and that really cured my hangover. And I thought I'd discovered the greatest invention of all time. But that's when things really began to get bad, because I knew how to cure my hangover. The way you cure your hangover is to drink on it. And if you play your cards really right, you can have two or three hangovers a day. So I got out of the Army and wanted to hook up with my old buddies and things like that, but they'd done things like get married, and get jobs, and settle down, and I still kind of wanted to party, and they didn't want to. That should have been a clue, but I kept on drinking. And I got a job teaching, and so I quit drinking, cut myself right off. And I read a book by Jim Bishop called it was about drinking. Jim Bishop was a drunk, and he wrote this thing, and he talked about taking a bottle of whiskey, putting it up on the mantle, and every morning he'd go look at that bottle of whiskey and say, "No, you're not going to get me." Well, I did that. I went and bought a bottle of Jack Daniels, and I was going to stay sober until Thanksgiving. Hard word. It has to do with gratitude, so I skipped my mind. Thanksgiving. Well, it stayed up there and stayed up there, and the night before Thanksgiving, I drank it and got just sicker than a pup. I thought it'd be fun to drink it. No, I just got sick because I tried to drink it all. And then I kept on trying to control my drinking, and I couldn't do it. And after a little while, it got in the way of my teaching. And so I did the noble thing and I quit my job teaching. Because I wasn't going to corrupt those poor innocent children. Mainly it gave me the freedom to drink as much as I wanted to, whenever I wanted to. But along about that same time, I started trying to quit drinking and failing over and over again. All the signs. And I was probably about 1956, I started really trying to quit. And I couldn't make it. And then I called AA. And a guy came and told me, he said, "You're definitely an alcoholic." He gave me 40 questions from Johns Hopkins University, and what could be more scientific and true than that? And the 40 questions, and I lied my way through as much as I could. And the snake in the grass, you know, if you answer three of them yes, you're screwed. Well, I answered 26 of them yes, and lied about the rest of them. It hadn't affected my marriage because I never got married. Hadn't affected my children because I never had children. Hadn't affected my job because I didn't have many jobs. So anyhow, I was convinced. He said, "You have a disease and it's going to kill you if you keep on drinking." And he talked about the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. And that was the first time I'd ever really thought about that. First time I came to the conclusion, because all I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was, this is over in Wenatchee and had the personnel column. Drinking problem, call Alcoholics Anonymous. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, and my name is Joe Smith. And I'll meet you by the third big tree from the corner of Mechow and Lincoln. And then I forgot my magic formula. The guy didn't show up, so I called him, "Where in the hell are you? You're supposed to be trying to save my life." Well, this is when he showed up and told me I was an alcoholic. And I then started trying to stay sober. And I used to think of those things as slips. I'd stayed sober for maybe a month, went to meetings, got to know people. I was amazed. This is on Sunday that I called this guy, and the meeting was on Tuesday. He offered to give me a ride. I couldn't drive right then because I had a, you know, goddamn cops, you know. Anyhow, they had it in for me. And anyhow, I walked all the way to that meeting, sat down way in the back. It was in the VFW meeting place, and tried to pretend that I was, you know, just an observer. And the people got up and they started talking, and I could not figure out how in 2 days they'd gotten all the information about me. I thought, those people have really got something lined up here. And then I thought, they must have a lot of money. And I had a whole bunch of these ideas because they knew exactly what kind of drinking I did and how I felt about drinking. And I couldn't believe it. But I kept in touch with my sponsor. His name was Pete. And he would go on and on and on. He was kind of a strange guy. He was not your ordinary AA. He had cards printed up for members of the Skookum group, Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "Well, isn't this supposed to be anonymous?" He says, "Well, if you have it in by your driver's license, when you get caught and they see that you're a member of the Skookum group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the cops might go easy on you." I thought there was something kind of funny about that. But anyhow, that's what he did. And he got me, carried the message, and ultimately he died of a wet brain because he just went out and couldn't come back. I moved back to Seattle and started, this is where I really started staying sober. I would stay sober for a little while and then it'd be Thursday and, well, maybe it's all right. You know, I can handle it this time. I've solved my problems. I no longer have that job. I don't have, you know, all these tensions. That's the same old lying BS that we keep telling ourselves. I came over here and I started getting serious. And I ended up hanging around a lot at the old Alamo Club, which was on 915 East Pine, the Odd Fellows Hall. Oh. They had meetings there all the time, and they had a place where you could hang out and drink coffee, play the pinball machine, play pool, and talk to other drunks. And it was there that that did me an awful lot of good, associating with all these people. And I wondered, how you stay sober? He says, well, you stay away from the first drink. You go to meetings and you don't drink. And finally, I managed to make it so I didn't have to drink anymore. I don't know why it happened, but I kept trying, but I kept coming back to AA. I was hooked on AA because they couldn't throw me out and they put up with me. And they, you know, and I thought they listened to me, but they were just being polite. And I tried to get hold of the program. And I remember saying one time, well, these steps are great, you know, but I can't do that fourth and fifth step. I can never forgive myself. And so one of the old guys said, well, you know, in your case, you might be, you know, I thought he was implying that I was special. If you started with the 10th step, maybe that would be good. Because at least if you start doing the 10th step, and when you're, you know, when you make a mistake, when you do it wrong, promptly admit it, then you won't have that piling up on that great big pile of stuff that you just don't even look at. So I did that. And I started getting better. And I hung around long enough to see that people were staying sober. People were staying sober and they were changing. So I came to believe that this worked, and I didn't have to worry about a higher power. I would argue with everybody about God and things like that. My higher power is better than your higher power. You know, this kind of silly stuff. And I'd say, how do you do it? Well, you just let go and let God. Well, how do you do that? Well, you just let go and let God. And I said, yeah, but. And so this is, my experience has always been, you know, hard to one. So I did it, and I wanted to become willing, to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it. And I read a book. My mother gave me something pious to read because she thought it would get my mind off my evil ways. It was called Father Malachy's Miracle. And Father Malachy was an old Irish priest who took care of poor people. And one time he went and called on a dying old sailor. And he was giving him the last sacraments and hearing his confession. He said, are you sorry for all the things you did wrong? Well, he says, yeah, pretty much, but those pretty girls, you know, I can't really be sorry for that. He said, well, are you sorry that you're not sorry? He said, yeah, I'm not sorry. He said, well, that'll do. And I switched it and I said, I'm willing to become willing. And I thought I'd invented something. And I asked God to make me become willing to become willing, and it began to work. Meanwhile, I was going through all sorts of stuff. I moved in with my friend up north, 96, right off Roosevelt. And his wife was having trouble drinking. So she and I and a couple other people started having a little meeting right in the house. And that was good. And then there was a meeting a couple blocks away called the Wright Group. The Wright Group was named after Mr. Wright, who's W-R-I-G-H-T. Mm-hmm. But they called it the Wright Group because it kind of got everybody else pissed off. But then Mr. Wright did something wrong, and his wife threw him out, so we couldn't meet at that place anymore. So we started this thing we're called the Northgate Group, and we met in this guy's house until we ended up meeting up at St. Catherine's Church, where we still meet. Well, we did until COVID. And that group, has kept me sober a long, 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 long time, or helped me. God's kept us all sober. And I've been sober for 62 years, which is amazing. But it's amazing that I've lived that long is the amazing part. It's amazing that I've stayed sober that long, because talk about picking the easier, softer way. I think this is the easier, softer way. But in the process, I ran across a young woman. There's an old gal named Gladys, who was from Canada, and she had a hold of this crazy woman, young woman, who couldn't get sober. And she brought her over to this house where these young people are having a meeting, and wanted to know if we could do something with her. Well, we tried, and over time, not long enough, I ended up getting married to her. And this is really against all the rules and common sense and everything else. We got married and we may have managed it for 48 years. You can imagine, we were still toxic when we were sober, really. And but we did it. We did it. And we managed to live a pretty good life, you know. Sometimes she would have to remind me that I was, she would say when I would really get upset and really get cranky and bored and all that stuff, you're going to get a 12-step call. And I'd get a 12-step call, and there you go. But she'd also remind me, ask me, what step are you on now, dear? And so she went to her meeting and I went to mine. She just didn't understand me, or perhaps too well. Anyhow, we had three children, and she said, you know, honey, it's wonderful. Our kids won't grow up to have the same problems that we did. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So we have three children who are all alcoholic, and that's been an adventure. They're all sober today, and they're all speaking to me. My wife died 13 years ago, she died sober. Pleased to have grandchildren, and she would have been sober 62 years on April 1st. So we made it, we managed it, and we just kept coming back. The thing that I think has saved me is the fact that I kept in touch with AA. I paid attention to the steps, and I paid attention to what people said, and I kind of let things kind of work on me. If people told me, all right, you've got to do this step right now, and I want you to you know, call me at 6:30 every morning, I would have rebelled. I would have not done it. But they say just a suggestion. Yeah, why don't you do it this way? Or maybe they're not, whatever. And I managed to bump along until I found there's something wrong in my life, and then I would look and see what step I needed to take, what would apply, and that would work. I would, but one thing I did do is you get sober and you give up one addiction, and then you get all caught up. I went back and made amends to my boss who was my boss at the where I was teaching, and I told him what I'd been doing, and that my flu wasn't Asiatic flu, it was alcoholism, and I was in AA. It's all good. And after I'd been sober over a year, they called me back and said, "Do you want to come back to work?" Nice. And so I did, and I worked there for many, many years. It was, but there I was at a point, I'm going to really, really work hard, and I'm really going to, and so I spent an awful lot of time worrying about grading papers and all this sort of stuff, paying more attention to that than to other things. The first commandment in the Bible says, "I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no strange gods before me." Well, there's money, there's sex, there's boats, there's cars, there's all sorts of things that you can put ahead of, and booze could put, make your higher power. But I managed even then to hang on to AA, and I still keep on hanging on to AA. I've had all sorts of adventures. We moved away from here to Colorado. We stayed sober in Colorado. We went down to Mexico and spent time there. I stayed sober in Mexico for the Amigos de Bill. And we watched our children struggle with addiction and come out on top. I'm not sure what the grandchildren are doing. They're all girls, and so they're sneaky. I tell them lies all the time, and they don't tell me anything. I think they just know I'm an old fool, who, you know, stumbling around, and maybe someday they'll tell me something if they think it's good. But I'm grateful for all those things that I have. I'm grateful for the fact that I keep running across people who keep telling me how to improve my life. The other night, we're down here, Pam, where'd Pam go? Anyhow, she's running the meeting. We were down here answering phones, you were here, and we got hold of a hot one. She was down in Walmart in Olympia, or someplace like that. And she kept calling up, and she called up and said, "Oh, I like you already." And then she'd rant and rave, and then hang up on us. Then she'd call back. So there were five of us people there, and four people got to talk to her. And she told me, "You better get another job, honey. You just suck at this." But I got her phone number, and I called her. I called her the next morning when I was down here, and she didn't answer. So I hope it rang and gave her a headache. But the poor thing, you know, she wanted to quit drinking, and she kept calling. And for some reason or other, people call this inner group a lot. You get calls from Wyoming, from Texas. Some guy in New York called one time, and you know, just one thing after another. You say, "Well, I'll send somebody out to see you. Where do you live?" "Well, Atlanta." You know, and you've given your best shot to this guy. Yeah. But I try to stay sober, and I try to stay of service. There are people who really get themselves organized and do really great things. I have to commit myself. Okay, I'll be down here from 10 to 2 on Thursdays. And on the fifth Wednesday from 6 till 10 at night for the group. So those things are in my schedule, so I have to do them. And I do. And I may not want to. I'll get up in the morning. Oh, shit. Today I've got to go to the room. I've got to answer the phones. Oh, God, it's boring. Well, whatever. I force myself to do that. That's the way I have to do it. I also have to organize myself in such a way that I have to make time and have a schedule for myself to do the things that I know really keep me sober. Royer's said that if you read page 86 for 2 weeks, it'll change your life. And he says it did. It changed his. And on awakening. So what I do on awakening is I go through these things that I say the prayer of St. Francis. I say the third step, relieve me of the bondage of self, whatever. And I say the serenity prayer. I say the Lord's Prayer. And then I get up and take care of other things. I just say those things. Now, half the time I'm so fogged in that I don't know what I'm saying, but I say them. And then I read the daily reflection. And I do that every day. And then after that, I used to go for a walk and then go to the Water's Edge meeting over on the Burke Gilman Trail. And I'd do that, but now I it's so easy to roll out of bed and put your shirt on and show up on Zoom. And you don't have your pants on. Is John O'Hare here? I think John has been seen in his bathtub.
Like Kurt Reynolds.
Yeah.
Got your number, John.
But that's. But we. And I was sure that this would never work. And people are getting sober on Zoom, and they never have been to a real live meeting. And so I think Zoom is here for good.
Yeah.
And I'm glad of it, but it's fascinating to see how AA has changed over the years. When I got here, they never had that last paragraph on the preamble. Our experiences before and after, and the chapter of the agnostic make clear three principles. They never used to say that. They all used to end every meeting with the Lord's Prayer, and they don't do that anymore. They used to have all their meetings start at 8:30 at night and go till 10. And it was midnight before you got back to bed. And now they're hour long and morning meetings and all that sort of thing. And I'm sure that everybody who saw them said, well, this won't work. But it has been working and works very well. I have to be grateful for the things that I have. And I have to see that, well, somebody said, even pain is a gift. Because, you know, if you have a sore finger, it says you got a sliver, and you should do something about the sliver. If you're heart sick and depressed, there's something wrong. That's pain. What are you going to do about it? And you can go get some mood elevators. You can go get drunk. You can do all sorts of things. Or you can go back and try to do the next indicated thing. And I try to do the next indicated thing and try to think of something besides me. So that whole thing about think of yourself, you know. Sit down quietly when you're not likely to be disturbed. relax the body and begin to think about yourself. And that'll happen to me if I don't go to meetings. I'll think about myself. And once I think about myself, oh God, look at what's going on in the world. Look at climate change. Look at the politicians. Look at, you know, look at the homeless people. Look at all that stuff. Well, and I'm responsible for all of it. Well, there's very little I can do about anything except get up, you know, brush my teeth, say the prayer of St. Francis and any other prayer that happens to hit me, and try to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And that's hard to do. Now, a guy came to me the other day, he said, hey, I got this great book. And it's a Tibetan book about living and dying. And it talks about building perfect compassion. And so he gave it to me, and he's been asking me, have you read it? Have you read it? I read it. I said, I've read it, yeah. And every time I read about something perfect, I give up. I give up because I can't be perfect. You know, I'm going to quit smoking. Well, yeah, all right. But I couldn't quit smoking. I couldn't quit drinking. I couldn't do that. I couldn't quit cussing. But thing of it is, he's got this book, and he brought it to me, and it made me think about what he's taught. We're talking about compassion. It's the same thing as love your neighbor as yourself. And it says love and tolerance is our code. Do I love everybody as myself? Hell no. I hate to admit that. With all these years of sobriety, I still think about Joe, you know? And that I'm sorry about that. But the chief activator of all my defects seems to be self-centered fear. And the only thing that I can do to get out of that is to pray to God and do something, like do the damn dishes or mop the floor or do something that's good for somebody else and not get anything for it. I was sitting around and I was madder than hell. The kids my grandkids were living with me. They hadn't done their dishes. They hadn't done this. They'd cooked something and oh God. There's, and I'm sitting there doing the dishes, muttering. Now, this is a job that I said that I'd take. I said, I'll do the kitchen. You guys do the rest. And I'm sitting there pissing and moaning about doing the dishes, which I'd volunteered to do. And in no time at all, I'm feeling pretty good. And why? Well, because I'm doing the next indicated thing. I'm doing something. Yeah. Sitting around, should I do the dishes? What's the matter with me? Oh, I don't know what's the matter with me. Remember one time, the old Aloha group used to meet at Seattle University. And at 5:30, I think, on Wednesday. And a guy came in. He was late for the meeting. He was huffing and puffing. And he said, I've just had the worst damn day of my life. He was a cook, or a chef, and the rat poison got too close to something or other, and the health department shut him down, and one of his chefs got drunk, and somebody else did this, and somebody did that. And then he'd missed the bus on the way to the meeting. And he said, I feel great. You know, my feelings have nothing to do with the facts, you know. The way it goes. So I don't know if anybody's got anything out of this. The steps are very, very important. Right now, I'm trying not to, you know, they say every time you got a problem, go down and write a fourth step on it. Well, I try to get it down. I try to figure out what it is. I try to quit lying to myself and say, what is this? One of the things I
found today was, excuse me, this may be the important thing. Well, there it all is. Yeah.
That's the sit down quietly thing. The other thing talks about what sobriety is. And I don't know where it came from, a bunch of papers. It says, first and foremost, sobriety means an absence from those artificial distractions, the ability and willingness to live calmly at ease with the world, usefully and with good purpose, regardless of the behavior of others and the frenetic nature of the world around me. That's pretty good. learning to recognize, understand, and apply the principles I've been taught in these rooms. Live not just to survive, but to value, enjoy, and relish the daily experience of life at ease with the world. And it says, I was taught to do certain things in this program, pray, sit quietly, listen to others and learn from their experience, and do what I can to be service to groups and individuals. I was given certain tools, pausing, inventory, making amends when appropriate, considering others. I actually get to use them. Plan practical, inventory, and consultation. Spiritual, asking for relief from defects, courtesy, and patience. Applications in certain circumstances, moving to God's waiting room. I'm 92 years old, and I get the feeling sometimes that I'm, when they're called next, it might be me. But I always wondered when I was a kid about how my parents were in their 50s. How could they go through life and not be afraid of dying all the time? I couldn't understand that. And they were happy, joyous, and free, chugging right along. And now I can see how you, if you're worried about dying, well, you're wasting a lot of time because it will come when it comes. And it will come the way it comes. But and I don't want to die drunk, and I just as soon be as happy as I choose to be. I found out that I can get up in the morning and I can be pissed off at everything because there's plenty to be pissed off at. Or I can be grateful for what I've got, and I've got a hell of a lot to be grateful for. I have a family. I had a wife for 48 years. I got grandkids. I got thousands of friends in AA. Now, a lot of them have died, passed on. But there was a guy, I don't know how many people here knew John. He used to work on Friday morning. We got to be friends. I got to be friends because he used to go out and wash and scrub the floor in the next room, empty all the garbage and all the stuff free. He did that free. And I admired him. And he was doing the same thing that I was doing. He committed himself to doing stuff so he'd stay sober. And we got to talking about how long it takes old men to take a shower in the morning, to get your blood warmed up and your joints moving. And the last time I saw him, I was taking him downtown to get his ORCA card renewed, and he died 2 days later. So he was going on just as if, and he died very quickly, and a heart attack, apparently. And somebody said, that's the best way to go. And somebody said, how in the hell do you know? Have you done it? That's the kind of stuff that I get in AA that keeps getting me back to the basics. So thank you very much for my sobriety. I've talked long enough.
Yep.
And God bless you all.
Thank you.